Okay, this is David Simon. I'm a writer and the executive producer of The Wire on HBO. This is Season 3, Episode 3, Dead Soldiers. Like men going to the gallows, our commanders, our hero commanders, have to run the gauntlet of Comstat. Comstat is actually a law enforcement technique that was implemented in the 90s. Various East Coast departments, probably nationwide, to try to establish a certain degree of responsibility and coordination among police commanders. But like everything that an institution does, it eventually has the capacity to become incredibly oppressive to its employees.
It was riding you now. Next week is somebody new.
So they're on the Eastern District Commander now. He's the whipping boy today.
The worst they can do is bust you back to lieutenant.
I don't even want to think about the worst these motherfuckers can do. You don't either.
You're still not connecting the dots, Marvin. Have a look.
Huffman and a Holbrook, sir.
I should credit our... our
you
tech,
had a body drop there last week.
Our tech guy, like Tom Farmer, who's been with us since the very beginning. He's the one that makes all of the on-screen Ashland computer Wolf. Work, on-screen video demonstrations as clean as they
Sir,
are.
I deployed my resources per your instructions.
Comstat came in from New York, and the history of the Baltimore Department is such that we had...
And the corners stay full.
They move, sir.
A period of a couple of commissioners being from New York and New York command sort of somewhere. Influencing the Baltimore
Major
Department.
Taylor, I look at your numbers. I
there
see
was a certain amount of resentment among the local
you're
Baltimore police
at
being at having outsiders come in and take over.
Me,
at the same time, it was sort of widely recognized that a house cleaning had been in order for many years. This started in the early 90s. And Comstat became sort of a symbol of the new regime. In some ways, it's actually a very good way of running things. I mean, you're making people accountable for their territory as police commanders. But again, the brutality of it
Anyone
in certain
else
departments sometimes overwhelms the original intent.
Dismissed.
Lenny Colvin's just about had enough, I think. Here come the Neville brothers again on the theme, third season theme. A lot of the editing work on the first three seasons, title sequences, belongs to Tom Zimney, along with Karen Thorson. We probably spend, as you might imagine, more time arguing about the shots in the credit sequence than anything else. It's when you have to reconstruct it every year based on the upcoming story and sort of anticipate the story, it's a very tricky thing. We buried that photograph of Bob Colesbury, my co-executive producer, the late Bob Colesbury. He passed away before the season began. And we managed to bury that memorial photograph of him from a scene that's upcoming in this episode in the credits, so that he was sort of a visual presence for the third season. Love the kid on the bike.
And I'm like, nigga, if you want to sell me a new car, you better really sell it to me. Because otherwise, I'm sitting back and I'm watching.
What you want with a new ride for? Hey, like, you can't get a new car anywhere you want anytime in this whole city.
I'm just saying.
You're saying what?
In case.
In case what?
One of the things that distinguishes Omar, there are a lot of things that distinguish Omar, but one of the things that distinguish him is his absolute patience, his willingness to endure much longer surveillances even than we see the police doing. He is absolutely determined to know what he's up against, to study the terrain. He's got a good head for tactics.
They're protecting the fuck out of it too. You see what you wanted?
Of course, here he's robbing the Barksdales on principle, even though they know he's coming. So it's always a problem. Boys out there now smoking on the
menthols. So we slide up from the back.
That balled up too.
No way through the front?
Not now. But come tomorrow morning, they gonna scale back down to a 3-man skeleton crew, you feel me?
Not sure I like this.
Why would y'all keep hitting up the Barksdale people?
Yeah, that's a good question.
This whole motherfucking city ain't got stashes all over it.
True that.
So why?
Revenge.
Because.
And the emotional have a great price on the wire. One that Omar's barely determined to pay throughout this whole season as his story arc brings him closer to the people who killed his lover.
Yeah, not much to him. But he did the job on the Dozerman kid last week. Gave it up in a full statement.
Before or after you knocked the shit out of him?
Injuries were sustained while patrol officers were effecting pursuit and arrest of aforementioned suspects.
Yeah, you know, like the remarkable job that Wendell Pierce has done with Funk. He is
dark on that back lot.
In every sense, the detective we imagined when we created the character. So what do you think? Were looking for someone who was McNulty's friend, who was his confidant in a way, but we were not looking for a sidekick. That was the one thing we were trying desperately to avoid. We wanted to give him his own internal dialogue. We wanted to make him
a murder bunker.
An equal among equals in that unit.
Is that we're supposed to be having less murders, not more.
This is
the salt and pepper team police sidekick cliche was something that we were up against, and we were fairly determined to avoid it.
No, sir. The kid said he sold it on the street. Gave only the street name of the buyer, a certain Peanut, whereabouts unknown.
You want that gun back?
Peanut has to be the official... elemental street name in Baltimore.
The great white deputy has spoken. This case is not done until
you
that
put
gun
Peanut
comes
into the police computer. It's just going to keep running forever. I don't know why that is, but
in the gun loving world, why should those ignorant motherfuckers,
for some reason, Peanut and Peaches, if it's a girl, there must be 10,000 Peanuts in Baltimore and 8,000 Peaches. This is the War Memorial Plaza across from City Hall in Baltimore. Don't get wet. We got rained on that night. We actually played the rain, I thought, nicely with the umbrella.
Thought you should know my boy Cheese. He went into the box with a couple.
We actually were going to film this elsewhere. No doubt. Kept his out by the chessboards in the plaza. There used to be chessboards. The city players along that tree line there. And because of the rain, we had to come indoors. So we're under the portico of the sort of Grecian temple that is the War Memorial that faces City Hall. And when we went up there sort of without warning to change our location because of the rain, we ran into a homeless city. There were 20, 30 people with bedrolls living under the portico, which, I love Baltimore and I've lived here a long time, but I found that to be the sheer depth of despair under that building that night, I found to be sort of shocking. I felt bad. We paid everybody an impromptu locations fee for having to move everybody. I felt terrible.
You keep it dead, fucking born.
Robert Chu, the wonderful Robert Chu, is an actor from Baltimore playing Proposition Joe. We used him on Homicide. We knew he was great then. I had him in mind for Prop Joe.
You're serious?
That's the real Jay Landsman. It's Mello.
It's close to school to here. Stuart Hill Elementary.
Trying desperately to hold his own with a real actor, Robert Wisdom. Jay started tight, but he's gotten pretty good. He's a pretty good actor. And we tease him constantly. The real Jay Landsman was one of the detectives in the Homicide book that I wrote back was published back in 91. He's still currently a Homicide detective. I'm not sure he's working Homicide, but he's working in Baltimore County. He's a police officer there. He retired from the city.
You called my desk looking for me?
Yes, I did. Come on in. Grab a chair.
Watch your wallet if you do.
Make it quick, Tommy. The new city editor wants a 40-inch weekender on liquor board reform.
They're going to reform the liquor board.
Yeah, with a hand.
This is actual, authentic newspaper dialogue, 40-inch Weekender. If we got nothing else right on this show, you can be sure that we got the Baltimore Sun Reporter right.
There's going to be no academy class of police cadets this year. Mayor's orders. Homicide rates climbing. Felonies are up.
This is notable. The up-and-coming city councilman is getting ready to slam the mayor, but he's doing it through a press leak.
Money's in the budget, but even a six-month delay in hiring saves a couple million.
You think there's some paper?
These are some of the first moments in the season sequence where you realize Carcetti's ambitions. They extend beyond.
You get that much?
The council.
You can come back to me for a couple of quotes.
You want in on this?
No, indeed. I love my mayor.
Councilman, thank you.
Staring up some shit.
He was very real as a reporter, right down
to the
good
of our first city by the bay.
We have no more charm than that.
Three twos.
Liar's poker.
Housing Authority has this slated for demolition, right?
This is Armistead Gardens. Over on the southeast side. We're playing it for the Western, though. One of those post-war housing projects that is being emptied.
Once, but I beat the dog piss out of the guy with a nightstick.
Anybody seen McNulty? Catch him up when he posts. New target, Kintel Williamson. Goes by Prince K. Has a string of corners from Park Circle to Woodland Avenue. And he's dropping bodies, too. Three in the last 4 months.
I think our art department did a wonderful job with this detail office, which we've used in season two. It really is modeled on an old State Highway Administration building that sits on Clinton Street, South Clinton Street, unless it's vacant. We've actually used the real building for the exteriors, and we very carefully modeled it off what would have been the interior of the building if it hadn't been racked.
They're still running product. Still got kids banging.
The idea of an off-site location for a wiretap detail is pretty common in police work.
Walk on, go about their shit like we were never anything to take seriously in the
first place. Because the wiretap laws, particularly federal wiretap laws, require you to really protect the integrity of the wiretap and to not allow people to have access to its information. It's pretty common to take a wiretap unit and put it away from a police precinct.
McNulty's here in spirit, anyway.
This was the beginning of a wonderful turn for Kima Greggs, where Sonya was playing almost as if McNulty's soul was encroaching on her character. And here we're doing what The Wire often does, which is playing the actual substance of a case almost without dialogue. McNulty's going to figure out
right there,
on the basis of physical evidence and physical logic of what small information he does have about D'Angelo's death, that it could not have been a suicide. He could not have hung himself from the door handle. It would ruin it to explain it. That's something that TV is you know, and even film, is usually remarkably brutal about. In their desperation to explain every last detail and to carry viewers with every possible nuance, they ruin the story. They make the story incredible. Because a lot of life goes by unexplained. Now, you can actually hang yourself on a door handle, and people have done it, and people do it.
This will work, too.
But you can't do it with that kind of ligature and that kind of strap.
That one over there.
This is over off Broadway in East Baltimore.
Otherwise,
just below North Avenue.
We're good.
What's happened to these beautiful federal-style row houses that I love so much? And that if you're from Baltimore, you love it.
Commissioner Burrell,
it's just shocking. It's just so tragic. How many of them are losing? How many of them are being bulldozed?
Irv, I'm giving you a heads up. You're going to get a call.
By the way, that gesture from Jay Landsman with the make-believe joint. The real Jay Landsman, and he is the real Jay Landsman, must have played that gag.
Exactly. And you call the mayor yourself,
I don't know, 3,000-4,000 times in his career. I actually stole it from him and then gave it back to him in the show. I can't tell you how many crime scenes I stood at or office meetings that I was in where Jay would respond to a question or to somebody's comment by lighting up an imaginary joint and passing it around. He really is a mental case. He's back in the world.
How you even find me?
Ran into Lucas.
Don't even call his name. The nigga still owes me money.
He just told me how to find you, that's all.
He tell you how I'm doing?
I've heard from a lot of people who've been away a long time in prison from Baltimore that when they come home, the city has changed so dramatically from what they remember. Even in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, if you got a good bit of time and you came home.
She ain't for none of our kind.
It's a little disorienting. A lot of, you know, empty blocks, boarded up row houses.
County clothes, county.
I guess I'm talking about east-west Baltimore, Lower Park Heights. You know, the areas that would constitute the ghetto or the hood or whatever you want to call it.
Where?
There are whole tracts of the city that are being reborn around the harbor. There's a great deal of affluence in North Baltimore. There are stable places in Northeast Baltimore and Southwest. Everything around the harbor, of course, is actually quite valuable in terms of real estate. There's a boom going on because of the number of Washingtonians buying housing here. But nothing seems to change East-West Baltimore for the better. It's startling to me just how different a part of America it is, and in that sense, The Wire is a chronicle of that America.
Up Ida B. Wells.
And it's a, you know, for the people who know it and the people who've lived there, it is nonetheless home, and they themselves are shocked by where things have gone.
Miss, my baby, can you just take that picture with you? Thank you so much. God bless. Have you seen this little girl?
Lady, you're going to have to back up.
My little girl, please. She's only 4 years old.
I ain't seen your little girl. You're going to have to back up.
Please, just take a look at her. Please, just look at the picture.
I ain't seen your daughter.
Uh-oh.
How do?
It's Omar. It's the Omar Show. This entire sequence was conceived by Dennis Lehane, the great Boston novelist, Mystic River and such, who wrote this episode. He had a lot of good ideas that were incorporated into this sequence. And when it came in, we left what he wrote pretty much intact, but told
Let's
him,
go.
You're going to kill us. This sequence is going to take, you know, a week to film. As it was, exactly. I think we got about 80% of what he intended. That we did have to scratch a couple of scenes on the interior of this house just because we were never going to finish.
So what up, man? You
Rob Bailey, who directed the episode, he went at it.
Please, hand me that school gun and call.
There were moments filming this where I thought, my God, we have done Mogadishu in East Baltimore. There was so much gunfire that the police kept getting calls from blocks away. They had to keep telling people that, no, they're just making a movie in Baltimore. When you shoot these things, when you shoot the action sequences on a film like The Wire, you're always conscious of, believe it or not, the American Western. Because in some respects, the inner city crime story, or the crime story in general, has taken the place in the American consciousness of the Western. So it helps when you're trying to at least be original or work within genre and find new ways to tell stories. It helps to be aware of what the elements that you're dealing with, the world that's already established. So,
oh, I got you, baby, I got you.
Lehane, Pelicanos, myself, Ed Burns, you know, we're all constantly referencing The Wild Bunch or The Searchers or Sergio Leone. We don't have opportunities to embrace it in any kind of pure sense. We're trying to be documentarian about the inner city and what we know of Baltimore, so, you know, it's never going to be as vainglorious as the final scene in The Wild Bunch or the final three-way gunfight in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly or anything like that, or the gunfight in Red River or My Darling Clementine, but we're always conscious of this stuff. And noir as well, and sort of the elements of gangster film. Everything is... A lot of film has been put out there. And to make film that feels fresh, you sort of have to know what's there before, and you have to think about what you can say that's still original. So everything references something. This ambush and this last stand, a lot of us were thinking about the opening sequence in The Wild Bunch, when they ride into town and are ambushed in their attempt to be the robber. And I took the same course at the University of Maryland in the Western as a film concept. 6 credits.
Your department leaks.
I'll have to check my transcript.
Well, it could be someone over here at the hall. Someone on your staff. Someone on the council.
I love what the art department did here with the mayor's office.
We gotta spend it the best way
there's
we
a
can,
lot of nice touches.
To step up and take this one for
the frescoes of Baltimore.
Me? Tell the newspapers that the academy class has been delayed.
That's
for some
the
reason.
City Hall building right above.
Problems in your
mayor
personnel
Royce.
Division. Keep it in your shop.
After which the mayor steps in.
This was our big set build for season 3. And Vince Piranha, like our art director, really had a lot of fun with it.
Mr. Mayor, this was a budget question. I was directed to delay that class.
We get to film in a lot of places in Baltimore. The city is very kind to us.
And I thank you for both.
They were a little stressed out when we first came on the scene, but they've gotten used to us, I guess, and been better hosts as we've gone along, and we've been better guests. But we don't film in the real mayor's office. That doesn't happen.
That's just the ones with West Side addresses.
Man, you got to narrow that shit down. Find somewhere to work with all them peanuts.
Motherfucker, do I look like George Washington Carver?
Cocksuckers got me chasing one gun through a city full of them.
Homicide, yeah.
This really is sort of a fool's errand, having Bunk try to recover the officer's gun. But it actually happened to Ed Burns' partner, Harry Edgerton.
Two down.
He was the deputy commissioner, assigned him specially to try to get recover an officer's gun that had been taken in a shooting.
Cutting in Cherry Hill last night.
I don't know that he ever did. But it certainly led to, weeks and weeks of aggravation.
Dozeman's prodigal gun.
You're gonna make me go back to back as a primary?
We steal from real life wherever we can.
That's some cool shit.
Figure that out. Real cases, real people, real places.
Hag of salt with a 2x4. I don't think so. Put that.
This is how you downgrade reports and you make crime go away.
Assault by pointing.
Every police commander knows the game. You can make an ag assault. Into the common assault, and it's no longer a UCR felony.
Fuck this.
You can make a robbery into a larceny.
Do it clean. Don't massage anything. Don't
make an assault
down.
By pointing, which is a serious assault, an aggravated assault where you point a gun at somebody into a common assault. If the guy has a fire bullet, it's just in how you write it, how you review it, and the degree to which you're willing to lie. And it's one reason that you can only truly measure a city's crime by the number of people shot
or
stabbed.
For a weekly felony tabulation
if they have that data, if they're willing to release that data, because you can't make bodies go away, and you can't make serious admissions to hospitals go away. You can disappear a rape. You can disappear a robbery.
I wish we were making more of an impact.
And
doing what we're doing.
That's the great game,
It's clear that's not the case.
Police officers get promoted when crime goes down.
I'm under
they don't
the impression
when crime
is
goes
down
up.
In the Western.
And they learn
perhaps
the game.
You misfigured your
and if you have politicians
stats.
That are willing to
no,
play games with it, then they
you're
play
very
games
accurate. Sometimes the gods are uncooperative.
Uncooperative? This is a cooperative effort, a cooperative department. Why, in the Eastern District, Lieutenant Daniels exemplified this new spirit just the other day. Because of that, we got 2 fresh homicides in the black and a lot less bodies on the streets than could have been had that drug war been allowed
Mayor
to drag
has
on.
Been taking the hit in public for
this
the
is what we're talking about.
Class. You're kidding
sacrifice
me. Where's
the greater
loyalty,
good.
Loyalty, I ask you.
But in the Western, what do I get from a veteran commander?
We play with the blinds in the Comstat room. It's a very subtle.
You got the real stats and projections somewhere else.
Subtle metaphor.
Just outside the door with them, right?
When somebody's trying to let a little light and a little truth into this room, sometimes the blinds are open.
She comes in, flashes a little tit, gives us a whiff of that.
There is a brutality about to happen when the political manipulation is en route to the people in this room. The blinds are closed. Here, the blinds are sort of half open because Colvin has decided to come in with clean, honest stats and take the hit for the increase. He's not going to lie about his own stats like everybody else in the room has been doing. The blinds are a little bit open, and there's a little bit of sunlight.
Have her job when she grows up because she sure as shit doesn't want yours. You know why? Because there isn't going to be a goddamn Western District in 20 years if this shit keeps up.
That's just got to be a bad morning, you know, going in, standing at the podium, trying to be honest, and have John Doman and Frankie Faison lay into you. It's just, it's not a good morning.
Will not save you.
You are my king.
And it's in this scene where we wanted to start dealing with something that was almost a fallout from the previous two seasons, which was we created a character that was...
Bystander?
He probably is the only character in The Wire that has mythic elements in him, which is Omar. And as a result, he had become this sort of iconoclastic hero figure, or anti-hero figure. And in the death of one of his crew, actually shot accidentally by... another of his crew. And in the sort of culture by which Omar is lionized, we realized something ugly was happening, which was Omar was becoming utterly heroic rather than an iconoclast and a myth and some of the things we intended. He had become a little bit outside or beyond the moral statement. So we wanted to start having Bunk reflect on that and start to acquire some genuine resentment of what Omar meant. And that idea really belongs to George Balcanis. He saw the need for it early. He saw the need for it, I think, in season two and started talking about it then with Ed Burns. And they were absolutely right.
I damn sure did something about it.
Yeah, I hear that.
I just want to move.
We first saw Jamie Hector in an independent film, a short film called Five Deep Breaths by Seth Mann.
So, Lieutenant, you got
we're just transfixed by his acting. We hired him right away, and then we got Seth to direct for us in fourth season.
Still, it's good work over in Eastern. Knocking down a drug war.
Yep, he's going to do the same thing for me up on Park Heights. I got this Kentel Williamson character who needs some fixing. Rawls promised me Daniels in his unit for about a month or so.
You're getting quite the rep there, kiddo.
So, Stan, what's your plan for the Southeast? How are you going to give Stan Rawls the numbers?
Al Brown just owns this role. And foot patrols in the Perkins home. He did such wonderful work in season three. We actually put him up for an Emmy. Kind of a fool's errand coming all the way from Baltimore and thinking they're going to notice the work of Al Brown, but they should. He really made Valchek into this wonderful, antagonistic political player within the department.
Thought I might legalize drugs.
And there was the line. That was, if you didn't know what season three was about, that was it. Colvin saying he was thinking of legalizing drugs and everybody looking at him like he's crazy or laughing.
I think I hit him.
Nigga, you ain't hit nobody.
I might have hit him.
Yo, straight. We hit the one girl.
This is all Dennis Lehane. This is just wonderful.
Nobody catch no lead, man.
Except for Tank.
It's the exact reverse of a Comstat meeting.
So I guess we even now.
Nobody taking responsibility.
So you get
but they're
one,
on
man.
The hot seat nonetheless. Yeah. And this 40-degree day line like that comes up.
Day.
We were when he turned the script in, we were crying. We were laughing so hard at it. It was just so beautiful.
50. Bring a smile to your face. 60? Shit, niggas is damn near barbecuing on that motherfucker. Go down to 20, niggas get they bitch on. Get they blood complaining. But 40, Nobody give a fuck about 40. Nobody remember 40, and y'all niggas is giving me way too many 40-degree days. What the fuck? Now, we gonna cover that bitch's funeral, her fucking wake. We gonna be all over that motherfucker till the bitch hit the ground. And if the faggot roll up to pay his respects, we gonna be on that motherfucker. Yo, who the fuck you talking to, man?
It's Darnell Shrink. She been calling.
No. Put the phone down.
I gotta go now.
Idris.
Are y'all feeling me on this?
Dominating a scene.
Yeah. You show up, you hit him like a motherfucking...
Like a 40-degree dick.
There it is. Thank you, Dennis. And Cuddy, still trying to get his bearings. This girl's now teaching middle school. Got a picture of a young club girl there. But she's changed. The whole story arc with Cuddy coming home, it really resonates against overall, George Pelicanos' fiction. He has a lot of characters that are living in that world and really hungry for redemption. And he does beautifully with it in his own work. And he really brought us Cuddy as a fully conceived idea.
If you're going to try to dig your way out of this, don't make me your shovel.
My department is bringing you casework that goes nowhere.
The cases are thin. Most wouldn't make it past a prelim in the court of a freshman judge.
Well, maybe if your personnel weren't so goddamn concerned for their goddamn conviction rate, they'd chance a whodunit.
The overall theme of this episode now becomes apparent on every level, in the drug trade, on the police side. Accountability is hard to come by.
Do something to help our sorry asses.
Everybody is passing a buck. Everybody is inconsistent. Everybody is ready to manipulate facts to their own personal advantage. In every meeting, in the one you just saw with Stringer, in the earlier Comstat meeting, who's on the spot, who's not on the spot is the only game that seems to matter. And yet the actual cost becomes evident in a subtle way by the end in terms of the rank and file. The dead soldiers, so to speak.
Always been a hack.
The idea of institutions callously disregarding and discarding the people on the lowest rungs and everyone else just trying to climb the pyramid.
Burrell's got friends.
The ministers? He might be their man.
Wire is, I don't think, cynical about individuals, about human beings. But I think it's very cynical about our modern and our postmodern institutions.
So you're tough on dead wood, huh? In the new 11th district, too, I hear. Mr. Mayor, it's time for Yunetta to go. She's had her time. There are better people out there for the council.
She's on the team, Odell, just like my police commissioner. I value loyalty. Don't you?
Funky bunk. Where's my bunk? Cole was up, not you. You're on Dozerman's gun, remember?
Cole was at the courthouse. Sue me. Rawls and Forrester have crawled up into my backside, and they're going to stay there until you find Dozerman's gun.
It's just a wonderful image, isn't it?
Very much. If I could unclench my ample ass cheeks.
There it is.
If you don't mind. And rid myself.
You write with such sensitivity, you know.
Jay, I just caught one that pushed his way all the way to the top of my stack. A victim, Jay. On the real side. Do tell.
Some days I feel... We publish a script, I feel like I have to call my mother and apologize. I do.
Caught in the middle of a firefight, takes one in the dome. But she's still dead in a zip code that does not fucking matter.
I love that line.
And you still owe me a departmental issue 9. Find the fucking gun, Bunk.
Delaney Williams. This is my personal connection with Delaney Williams, which I did not know until after he was working for me. I grew up within a block of the greatest, the only great delicatessen in Washington, D.C., the Parkway Delicatessen on Grub Road. I still go back there occasionally, although we do have Atmans here in Baltimore. Anyway, I grew up on their food. And somewhere after we hired Delaney and he was working and we were talking about our background, I realized he grew up in Silver Spring near me and we were talking, you know, you know this, do you know that place? And I had to say it because everybody who lives down there knows. I said, do you know the Parkway Deli? And he actually says to me, I worked there 5 years. I said, what? He said, no, I was the guy cutting meat on the cat. Don't you remember? And he gave me the, and of course I looked at him like square in the face and I realized the guy had been feeding me for most of my, you know, my late adolescence. So now he's an actor and I'm pretending to be a writer and we're working together. You know, the entire world is made up of 200 people. We just move around a lot, very fast, you know. This is Omar dealing with the idea of self-recrimination, the idea that he's responsible now for another death. I thought this was an amazing moment. And alone, in this episode where no one is willing to take responsibility, and where all the leaders seem to be placing blame on someone else, we have Omar, who is flawed.
It was my fault. You hear me? Sorry, yo.
He at least knows his flaws, which for a human being is pretty epic. And he regards himself as responsible, which, you know, in the world of The Wire, is epic. We just did that because, you know, in every other scene down by the railroad tracks, somebody was taking a leak.
They know you police when they hook up.
We decided it was Kima's turn.
And they know you police when they move in.
The railroad track that we use is just southwest of the B&O Railroad Museum, which sits at the originating site of the B&O Railroad, which was the first railroad in the country. And this is pretty much some of the first track laid in any American railroading map. This would be mile 1, mile 2, mile 3, mile 4.
I want to come down here tomorrow to the Western. See what's what since those towers came down.
We supposed to start on Kintel tomorrow.
Oh, fuck that chump. You can wait a day or two.
Yeah, okay.
There's a visual and symbolic theme in The Wire of declining industry, of a lot of life going on around the vestiges of what was industrial Baltimore, this sort of post-industrial carnage or
here and down on Winchester jetsam. Under the bridge.
But there that lies around the city. You saw a lot of it in season 2 around the port. You know, around we saw shots of Beth Steele, which has gone bankrupt. There was an earlier episode where I think it was an earlier episode, or maybe it was in this season. But I know there's a scene where Bodie and Stringer Bell have a meeting, and Stringer Bell has the meeting on the waterfront at what is accurately described as the Baltimore Museum of Industry. The idea that industry would be in a museum, that it would be a museum piece unto itself, was sort of the culmination of that visual theme. So the railroad tracks and the broken rail stock that they're always drinking around, that was an intention. Buddy looks good in a suit, doesn't he?
No, me, Ma, you know I can't.
Well, times like these, honey, you have to shine. In your face, in your clothes, and in your pocket. They're gone.
Make sure you get something to eat here.
No.
You know?
Not a clue. Well, that corner looks familiar.
One of the things that we have to do on The Wire, just because it works visually,
not many.
We have to cheat the distances by which actual surveillance could be accomplished.
Why, though?
Now, to be honest, if McNulty and Greggs were really trying to get a careful look at these corners, they'd either have to be up in a row house, in some vacant row house, or you know, put a tarp out on some tar roof and be looking down, or they'd have to be parked another block and a half away. We don't have those kind of, we can't get that kind of long lens work and have it really work. In any kind of visual sense, we can't tie everything together at the distances, or you'd have to do every shot through a binocular, which has its own problems.
You let me know, right?
The corners are very attuned to surveillance.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. You know Ray Cole?
Thomas Edward.
And this begins a sequence that we thought about a great deal. Bob Colesbury had passed away tragically between seasons 2 and season 3. He was my partner, in many ways my mentor, or one of my mentors. A talented man, somebody who gave himself wholly to whatever project he worked on. And he also played Detective Ray Cole in the show, this sort of hapless Baltimore homicide detective. And so, in deciding what we were going to do with Ray Cole and how we were going to respond to Bob's death, we consolidated the two and came up with a way we thought it was a genuine tribute to Bob. And because Bob thought obsessively about every detail of the show, we made sure to think obsessively about every detail of what we were trying to say with the tribute. Acknowledged that money had been budgeted for the Academy class. But said the department was Bob was a real soft-spoken, casual, behind-the-scenes kind of guy. Very impassioned about what he wanted to do with film, but at the same time, he was really gracious and really smart. He was the kind of guy who would let everybody in the room talk themselves out, and then he would very gently steer the discussion in the way it was supposed to go in the first place. So the last thing we wanted to do was have something grandiose happen to Cole. So we had the detective, you know, he died in the, you know, on a Stairmaster at the gym. It was, there was some affection irony in that because Bob really did try to take care of himself. But more than that, it was sort of a quiet, behind the scenes, off camera type of death. It seemed like the place to start since, you know, Bob was always the power behind the throne.
Remember what I told you? Police is only as good as his informants.
Yeah, well, we ain't downtown no more, Kima. We're in the trenches here. You want information, you go get your own CI and you shoot the shit.
You're late, Sergeant.
I had a couple downtown detectives in my shop. They were confused and required assistance, sir.
Playing the, natural argument that exists between downtown CID and all the districts.
We want to push it.
Push it, boss?
They'll go easy, then they go hard. But we let these knuckleheads know that if they move to these areas, away from the residential streets, away from commercial areas, away from schools, if they take their shit down the road...
This is the beginning of Colvin's Hamsterdam plan. Which is really triage. It's societal and political triage, where you reach some sort of accommodation with a social problem rather than pretend that you're actually controlling it. The drug war is such a disaster, such a failure of policy and failure of, not failure of will, but failure of strategy and failure of tactic, that for anybody to begin to tell the truth about it, the logic seems so apparent, and yet you can see how politically untenable it is. Here he is trying to tell his own troops that if they push the drug dealing to certain areas where it'll do the least damage in the district, they should let those areas thrive, which just goes against everything that's in the souls of these cops.
You still get to kick the shit out of all the mobs that don't move off our corners.
To reach any kind of accommodation with that which has been labeled the enemy in a war is just, it's too much for people. And yet it's the only way out of the dilemma, is to surrender in some sense.
Come on, girl. Come on, man.
Come on, girl. You got to stop for Cuddy in a suit. Come on.
So this a ride? It's nice.
I suppose you got a Lex.
Nah, girl. Got a bus pass.
You at the game, then?
Look, he's telling the truth, too. Doing a little landscape. How can you resist? Right now,
but trying to figure things out. So, what's your boy's name?
Chad Coleman not only owned the part of Cuddy here and Ever After, but Drazon James, who played Grace, also played the ne'er-do-well sister who tells him where to find Grace. So she was in a dual role here, and I think she did beautifully because she was so distinct in each one. I think they may have gotten by viewers that she actually she played both sides of the coin. In the Hollywood world, you get the girl. If you don't get her right away, you get her by the end of the film. And one of the things we were trying to speak to was redemption, not as this classic, oversold, stylized version of the comeback, but as a real painful, a real slow, a real, you know, two steps forward, one step back process. Chad Coleman really embraced that and I think really internalized it. It's a remarkable performance.
Grace, looking at you.
What?
Hurts.
Shouldn't look bad.
Damn. I'd drink on that, Cuddy.
Fool Blast taking mind off it.
I'd rather my mind on than the boss.
Swear, I'm sick of all this, man. Wondering when I got so old. Some more mac and cheese, man.
Hey, Bubs.
Hey, man.
Hey, Bub.
Nutty, man. My main is man.
McNutty.
Ready to put some work in?
Born ready.
Snitching? Fuck that, Bubs.
Hey, nah, man. You better lift 500-pound radiators.
When Andre Royo, the first time,
that's easy money, man.
Come on.
Called McNulty McNutty on camera, every writer sat up and said he can never be McNulty again from Bubs' mouth. It was just poetry. The small details of misapplication that make writing real. That's that circular thing that happens between actors and writers. They come up with something, and if it's good, we steal it. If we throw them something that they like, they steal it and use it again.
And he's up for re-election, and he's never had a single one of his goo-goo bills pass the committee, so he's got one for all-day kindergarten. I mean, who's gonna
this is the world of Carchetti.
I mean, this guy's got a bill which is the legislative equivalent of kissing a baby.
And the soul of Carchetti.
So, right, he goes to his chairman, his case, and says, you know, this don't go through on
we really wanted to play this for a story that he's holding court.
He gets the bill to the floor. But the House Speaker, he hates this bill. So
and loving the story,
death, you know?
But maybe loving it because it's just pure inside politics.
Subsidies, handouts, and the bill goes down in flames, 122 to 10. The delegate, he can smell those paint
the
cans.
Idea
the
of
says, hey, sorry, brother. I
him being
like a, tiger for that
a leader, of him being able to speak to ideas has not yet emerged. What he's able to speak to now is the inside baseball of politics.
I need to talk to him.
He's able to hold a small court.
Look, just tell him it's
with those kinds of stories.
Yeah, he know who the fuck I am.
That was the intent of that scene.
She said, not now.
Place him in that context.
Look, he said not now. I gotta go. Marlo, it's a problem, String.
Club soda in line.
One problem after another.
You'll never get there that way.
Get where?
And again, he's also not entirely mayoral.
Excuse me.
In another sense. Or maybe he is.
How the hell was I to know the mayor was going to put the screws through you?
I read the paper.
But one thing we were trying to do with Carchetti early was place him in this sort of backbencher ambition, and yet does he have the political skills place? This begins something that, you know, I figured if ever Bob was gonna get on me about shot sequence and about what we were doing and how we were telling a story with film, it would have to have been on this scene, which is basically the show saying goodbye to Bob Colesbury.
We are police.
We went late this night. We worked hard on this. We argued over every frame.
He wasn't the greatest detective.
There he is.
And he wasn't the worst.
We tried to have the moment veer towards being maudlin and then walk right away from it with wit and comedy and affection.
You remember the Mississippi extradition?
In this eulogy, Landsman, the voice of the homicide unit, he's actually invoking some of the best film projects by Bob Colesbury.
93, the drug wars.
That's the corner that Bob and I worked on.
Yes, indeed.
Talking about the Mississippi burning, the arson case in Mississippi, you know, the extradition from Mississippi. That was Mississippi Burning, which was one of Bob's best films. After Hours, the After Hours joint, that was After Hours with Martin Scorsese. They were all affectionate references to the great work that Bob did as a filmmaker and as a producer.
No fucking doubt. I think the last one actually kind of got used to him, thank God.
That was a nod to Karen Thorson, who was married to Bob, and is one of our producers.
And cheat on his taxes and forget to call his mother and fuck
and then, you know, I started listening to a lot of a lot of different music for this scene, and the Pogues just naturally came into it.
Baltimore City Police.
And Body of an American, which seems to tell its own story in its own way about life and about loss, just became this thematically perfect thing. And the idea that a homicide detective as tradition would be laid out at the bar at Kavanaugh's, which Kavanaugh's used to be the bar where they all used to hang out. So it's a lesbian bar now. They sold it. But it used to be up on East Madison Street, and the detectives used to close it most every night. The idea that they would lay a guy out on the pool table and do a detective's wake and then sing this song seemed entirely reasonable. They don't have this tradition, but they should. Lainey did such a great job with that. It's just beautiful. And then the idea that all the detectives, not just the Irish ones, would know the song because they've been to enough wakes. It was very, very, very evocative. Tom Wolfe once wrote that all cops become Irish no matter who they are. I think that's on some small level true. And then when the song kicks up, it becomes less maudlin, and it becomes a genuine celebration of a culture, of a policing culture. And then the toast to Bob. We shot the hell out of that scene. I felt like we had to. I felt like if there was ever one scene we were going to do right ever again, it had to be the sending away of Bob Colesbury. Sending off, the home going.
So you'll be a while though, huh?
You can't help it.
Gotta work the crowd, you know. Make them think I'm worthy of their faith.
You are.
Well, thank you.
Most of the time.
Bitch.
And there was a lot of talk in Baltimore that our creation of the Carchetti character really reflected the actual white mayor who had an insurgency. As a councilman, he ran this wonderful insurgent campaign and became mayor. There was a suggestion that we were working off that. Well, you know, there are elements of what we know in politics, but Carchetti is really a creation not just rooted in O'Malley, but rooted in half a dozen other reformist campaigns and candidates. We really weren't doing O'Malley. And I say that because here we're giving him a moment of faithlessness that has nothing to do with Martin O'Malley. What we're basically trying to say is, like a lot of characters in The Wire, he's not rooted in genuine ideals, so that it's reflected in maybe personal flaws that we create for the character. But fiction is fiction. You know, it's not the real, and if it were the real, it would be labeled as such. And, you know, that's not a writer trying to be clever and backing off from the origins of what he's written. it's speaking to what writers do in a writer's room and why you do certain things with characters.
You're still owing him a clearance on that Omar thing.
Oh, I know. I fucking know.
Like that.
Pogues are still singing, Sally McLaughlin.
Fucking Stairmaster.
This drunken reflection on life and loss is interrupted by Ed Norris, the actual police commissioner and later state police superintendent in Maryland, vomiting in the street. I'm doing it rather well in my head. I love this wide shot tableau. Bunk offering him more liquor. Sign says, do not enter, and the hearse waiting for the body is parked the wrong way on a one-way street as these guys are seemingly drinking themselves into oblivion. There was all kinds of symbolism intended in that wide shot. All kinds of symbolism intended here, but I can't remember what it is. And then again, back to the theme of dead soldiers. You've seen three people die in this episode. The two at the gunfight with Omar. Omar makes sure his girl is laid out. He pays for the place, but of course it's all staked out by Barksdale people. And there's nobody in the visiting room and nobody coming to call. She's alone at death. But at least more cared for than the guy who we just saw drop in the street, and we never even acknowledge his passing. And then there's the death of Ray Cole, set against that, in which a more viable and a more intimate culture gathers around almost desperately to celebrate and make meaningful life. So, dead soldier. And there's Bob. So thank you for listening, and thank you for buying or shoplifting or otherwise, you know, stealing your brother's copy of season 3 of HBO's The Wire. I guess this is number 3. We'll be back on number 11. Whatever.